People's Tribune Radio is on the air. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. On this edition of PTR, we hear Sharon Delgado, a Methodist minister, speaking on the topic of the Unholy Trinity, the WTO, the IMF, and the World Bank.
I don't know if you're aware of the magnitude of the debt. We often get the idea that because we're in the richer nations and we give foreign aid and such, that we're really helping. You know, we're really giving a lot to the poorer nations. But counting the debt, there is a net transfer of resources, net, from the poor countries to the rich countries every year to the tune of about $50 billion. We're draining the poor countries. The poor countries are feeding the rich countries. And Robert McNamara, who's a past president of the World Bank, says this is like giving a blood transfusion from a sick person to a healthy person.
That, plus an editorial from pages of the People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo, on police abuse in America, what's the solution? People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also publish the newspaper, People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program. Methodist minister Sharon Delgado lectured on the topic of the Unholy Trinity, the IMF, the WTO, and the World Bank at a speaking engagement in Nevada City, California. Sharon Delgado.
I was in Seattle. That was, as you all know, I'm sure, events and activities, worship services, teach-ins, and protests focusing on the World Trade Organization that many people didn't even know existed until Seattle. Well, now there's something else coming, and that's in April. In April, there's another series of events planned in Washington, D.C., and that begins on April 9th is the big Jubilee 2000 celebration and human chain, and not exactly protest, but more a demonstration of the support that there is in this country and around the world for canceling the debt of the world's poorest nations. And that'll be the first part of the events. The whole week is dedicated to lobbying and teach-ins and a variety of things, because on the 16th and 17th is a big meeting of the leaders of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, two other powerful global institutions that shape the world economy. And there are also protests planned, as in Seattle, and I am planning to be a part of that, as well as I'm going to be resourcing a United Methodist seminar on national and international affairs on the 8th, and that's a seminar on Jubilee 2000, but I'll be talking about these issues of the so-called unholy trinity, the IMF, World Bank, and WTO there as well. I want to mention a little bit more about Jubilee 2000, because today in this church, I came to church here whenever I'm up in Nevada City. I always attend worship here, and it's like coming home. But today, after worship, the congregation signed on to Jubilee 2000. As I said, that is an international movement, really, because there's Jubilee 2000 USA, Jubilee 2000 Africa, Jubilee 2000 Great Britain. There are many different organizations, but it is an international movement to cancel the debt of the world's poorest nations. Jubilee 2000, the whole idea, Jubilee, comes from chapter 25 in the book of Leviticus in the Bible. It actually originated from church folks, this whole movement. And Leviticus 25 talks about a time for the Israelites when debts are to be canceled, slaves are to be set free, The land is to be returned to its original owners, so there's no massive accumulation of land by a small group. And the land to be left fallow for a year and other things. So that's where that whole idea comes from. I don't know if you're aware of the magnitude of the debt. We often get the idea that because we're in the richer nations and we give foreign aid and such, that we're really helping. You know, we're really giving a lot to the poorer nations. But counting the debt, there is a net transfer of resources, net, from the poor countries to the rich countries every year to the tune of about $50 billion. We're draining the poor countries. The poor countries are feeding the rich countries. And Robert McNamara, who's a past president of the World Bank, says this is like giving a blood transfusion from a sick person to a healthy person. And the richer have continued to get richer, the poor poorer. You've probably heard that over and over. But at this point, the top 20% of the world's population every year consume 86% or receive 86% of the world's resources. 80% of folks on the bottom have 14%. And this, it's growing, this gap, and the difference is growing every year. There, an example is Mexico, where billionaires, there are so many, I don't remember how many more billionaires there are now than there were 5 years ago, but so many more billionaires. Meanwhile, the wages of people, of the average wages are cut in half. Tortilla subsidies are gone, and people are hungry. Healthcare has been cut. Education's been cut. And this model has been duplicated around the world. And so the question is, why? There's a phrase, it says, the system is designed for the result it's getting. The system is designed for the result it's getting. There is a payoff here. And so tonight I want to talk about the economy, the global economic system as a whole, and the institutions that make the rules for the global economy, because there are rules. And so there's input and influence by transnational corporations, by large banks, and by the leaders of government of the richer nations. Our country has a huge amount of influence in these institutions, but it isn't always to our advantage either. That's real clear as well. I want to talk about what the video called the rulemakers of the global economy, the IMF, WTO, IMF, World Bank, and WTO. These three institutions, it isn't just a fluke that there were people in Seattle and now there are going to be people in Washington, D.C. These institutions are related. They're related because the World Trade Organization, the WTO, grew out of or was transformed from something called the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades, and that was January 1st, 1995, is when the World Trade Organization came into being, and the GATT was the precursor organization, and that was formed at the same time as the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, and that was in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, in 1944 at a meeting. I want to ask, by the way, was anybody else in Seattle? I know Mike was. Was anybody else up there? Okay, just wanted to find out. So they were all thought up at the same time, and it was right at the end, at the ending of World War II. The developed nations came together, the leaders of the developed nations, particularly the United States. The United States really, I don't want to say dominated exactly, although they do dominate even now, but they brought everyone together and exerted a great amount of influence, and they still have their headquarters in Washington, D.C., and so the U.S. really has a profound influence. And I know for the World Bank, the way the voting works is $1, one vote. That's not true of the World Trade Organization, but it's true of the World Bank, and I'm not sure about the IMF. But they were formed at Bretton Woods, and I want to mention that the whole foundation upon which they were formulated, two things. One, it sounds like a good idea, the reason why they were formed, because they came together to form a way for the countries of the world to interact through trade so that they wouldn't have world wars. I mean, it really makes sense. You know, you form bonds that unite countries through trade, and then they aren't going to have these major kind of wars. That's a great idea, and hopefully we can continue to have interaction and trade and a variety of ways of communicating with each other for peace. But there were two things that were part of a faulty foundation. In part of the opening speech at Bretton Woods, two things were said in the opening speech that were wrong, that we know now were wrong. They didn't know then were wrong. The two assumptions. One assumption was that economic growth would lead to a better world for all people. You know, that all people would share in the benefits of economic growth. And we know now that that's not the case, it isn't necessarily the case, and it isn't the case now the way the world is structured and the way the economy is working. The other faulty foundation, and the actual words that were used, were something along the lines of the infinite bounty of natural resources. The infinite bounty of natural resources. So the assumption was, back in 1944, that we wouldn't run out, that the tropical forests wouldn't be cut down, that only 5% of the old growth forests in the U.S. would be left in the year 2000. So the idea that it was unlimited resources and unlimited growth and everyone would benefit, those are two things that have been proven to be false. And yet, the same foundational ideas that were functioning then are functioning now as in practice. And in all of the way that the whole idea of free trade, unlimited economic growth, and these kinds of ideas are being promoted, it's kind of unquestioning. And it's the consensus. There's a consensus that is out there and that you hear on the press. Very rarely do you get an alternative view, a view like John Cobb, a theologian, and Herman Daly, a past economist from the World Bank, who have a whole alternative system of economics that talk about ways of measuring economic success and relating it to success in terms of people's well-being and the well-being of the environment. Because as you may know, right now, the way we measure success in economic growth and so on, it often is, well, if there's a toxic spill and it costs a lot to clean it up, that's a plus. If you do wonderful things that happen and volunteer labor and so on, it doesn't count. Tragedies count, and a lot of money spent to clean up messes essentially counts, and more valuable, I mean, that's necessary, but valuable things do not count. And so there are alternative models to look at as far as the economy goes. So for 55 years, we've been able to see the effects of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. And the effects are pretty disastrous, and the debt crisis is one manifestation of the problems of that. The WTO is only 5 years old, but we can still see the problems with the effects on poor people, on workers, on the environment, and on human rights from the WTO as well, even though it's only been 5 years. And I can go into great detail about the WTO and some detail about the other institutions. And I want to start with talking about the World Bank and the IMF. We fund both organizations, as do other countries, with tax dollars. The World Bank is there to loan money, and it loans money for development, particularly development to poor nations. Over its history, it has funded projects almost always, big, huge projects, large developments, development that takes less staff oversight and gets more money moving faster, because they actually have loan targets, and they have pressure to lend, the World Bank does, like other banks. They've funded power plants, dams, forest development, so that the cutting down of forests and building roads into forests and so on. And these are pushed. And on the video, you saw the Sardar Sarovar Dam in India, that huge development that the people resisted. In India alone, 30 million people have been displaced because of dams. Mostly funded by the World Bank, and also the World Bank guarantees loans from private commercial banks. And so 30 million people, indigenous people, native people, and small farmers, subsistence farmers, and many hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, I don't know, of rainforest, of acres of rainforest, and of forests have been submerged as well. Terrible environmental damage. But that's just one country. It's repeated all over the world. In fact, the World Bank itself says that 37% of its projects, this was about 5 years ago, a study that they did that was made public, because it also has a terrible secrecy problem, keeps things secret. We do not have a right to know. There's no right to know what the World Bank's studies are, although a little bit of that has improved because of U.S. pressure. But 37%, they said that 37% of their projects had serious problems. One of their favorite phrases, though, is learning by doing. They're still learning by doing. So learning by doing, they're not learning very fast. They know what's going on, and then they choose to do the same thing. And there are 10,000 employees. It's a huge bureaucracy. And there's an analysis by William Stringfellow that I really apply to this and to all these institutions, that institutions, I even see it in the church often, institutions are created for some purpose, often, usually, a human good, but institutions tend to take on a life of their own. And so you can even get to the point where, instead of the institution serving the needs of life, that the people are serving the needs of the institution to keep the institution going and so on. Also, a lot of the banks, the World Bank's projects, the money went to dictatorships and really corrupt dictatorships, such as Ceausescu in Romania, Pinochet, Marcos, but the list goes on, who they loaned to. And then the money was often just either whisked out of the country or used to prop up military dictatorships. This is irresponsible lending. Even though the UN had a resolution that said that UN-related institutions, although this isn't a close relationship, but would not lend to South Africa, but the World Bank did anyway. Their justification is they can't be involved in politics. The IMF and the World Bank, I'm going to move on to the IMF, and I'm going to talk about the World Bank and IMF together now, because they both do another kind of lending, and that's called structural adjustment lending. What that means is it's like a refinancing. You'll refinance if somebody's so indebted that they can't pay and they're having a hard time. The World Bank and the IMF comes in to help. And the way they come in to help, which hasn't helped because the nations almost all are further indebted than they were before they got this help, they come in to refinance, and it's essentially it serves to keep the money flowing, the interest payments flowing to the banks. And the way they do it is they impose, in order to refinance, they impose the structural adjustment policies on these countries. The austerity programs are similar to what we're seeing in this country. Some people are calling what's going on in our country today structural adjustment in the United States. You cut health care and you privatize it. You cut food programs, programs to the poor. You cut education and you privatize that even so that people have to pay. In the poor countries, when you have austerity programs and you cut basics like tortilla subsidies that have always been there and that people are dependent upon, you have starvation. 30 of the 47 nations in Africa have undergone these structural adjustment programs. The other aspect that of the demands are political, and they repress the labor unions. They insist that they gear their economy toward exports so that they can't focus on feeding their own people. They have to focus on exporting so that they can get the foreign currency, the dollars, so that they can repay their loans. They have to make it as attractive as possible for transnational corporations to come in, which means they have to give them tax breaks. They have to they make all kinds of concessions. And we see that in poor communities in this country. Oroville, California, my hometown, is considering becoming a foreign trade zone is what they call it, but so that there's all kinds of breaks to attract corporations, which often ends up putting the local businesses and artisans, craftspeople out of business, and often creates a capital drain anyway that the money goes out of the community.
Sharon Delgado relates a lesson learned as a result of the protests which took place at the WTO ministerial meetings in Seattle, Washington last year.
As powerful as these institutions are, it seemed to me there for a moment that it was just like a house of cards, that when you consider the power of the people and the power of an informed public to be responsible and make decisions about how life is going to be, that those kinds of institutions really don't stand a chance. The demonstrations there showed people around the world that there are people in America who do care, which people sometimes doubt and question. It showed the leaders of the developing nation, the delegates from the developing nations inside, that there was protest, that everything wasn't just going to be pushed through. The people in the inside had some serious problems about some of the things related to labor, genetically modified foods, and so on. And so they didn't like that the Quad, the U.S., the European Union, Japan, and Canada came in with something for them to sign on the dotted line. They didn't like that they had been excluded from processes. So there were a lot of reasons why the meetings ended in failure. It was announced on the last day that the meetings ended in failure, that there would be no new round, no millennium round. And our whole theme for the week had been no new round, turn around. Actually, I think that the WTO is irredeemable. We need to eliminate it and start from scratch. There need to be trade agreements, but it needs to be negotiated with a broader group. And as far as Washington, D.C. goes, there are a lot of the same things planned. But I want to say one thing about the importance of the Washington event. I think it's really important because if Seattle was a one-time thing, it was a one-time thing. If somebody said, my friend Peter Lumsdaine from the Resource Center for Nonviolence in Santa Cruz said, if it's a dot, it's a dot. But if there are two dots, then you've got a line. So if you've got another event that not necessarily does the same thing, but makes clear that there is resistance, growing resistance to this corporate globalization, this domination by corporations that is now becoming global, it'll be clear that there's a growing movement and that more things will happen. And so that's why I think that Washington, D.C. is a really important event to pay attention to. And there will be support activities in different communities around the country and around the world, actually.
Various events and activities are scheduled to take place in Washington, D.C., including the Jubilee 2000 campaign on April 9th and the protest against the World Bank and IMF meetings on April 16th and 17th. And we've been listening to Methodist minister Sharon Delgado lecturing on the Unholy Trinity, the WTO, the IMF, and the World Bank at a speaking engagement in Nevada City, California. This is People's Tribune Radio. And now, an editorial from the pages of the People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Police terror in America? What's the solution? By now, virtually the whole world knows the name of Amadou Diallo, the man who died last year in a hail of 41 bullets fired by officers of a special street crime unit of the New York City Police. And the latest outrage, of course, is that Diallo's killers have been acquitted. But ask yourself, even if the killers had been found guilty of murder, would the campaign of police terror stop in New York or anywhere else? In fact, the killing of Amadou Diallo and the freeing of his killers is just the latest horrific chapter in a story that has many other chapters in nearly every city in our country. The real question is, who will write the ending to this story? Will it be the people or the police? In the guise of the war on drugs and crime, the police have systematically terrorized poor neighborhoods across the country. But the ultimate goal of this campaign is not simply to cow these neighborhoods into submission. It is to set the stage for terrorizing anyone who is a threat to the existing system. First, the poor of every color and nationality are stripped of their rights, and then no one has any rights. Today, the powerful are reaping the deadly crop that has been sown, and we live with the results. More powers for the police, fewer rights for us. But many well-meaning people, terrified by the lurid publicity about crime and deteriorating conditions in their own neighborhoods, are fooled into taking the side of the police. The war on crime becomes the justification for creating an apparatus of murder and oppression that threaten every one of us, no matter what color we are or where we live. The real question in all of this is who will control society and for what purpose? The morality and intentions of the ruling class are clear. They intend to go on having a society that is a money-making machine for them, even if it means imposing an all-out police state to keep the rest of us in line. Their vision of America is a threat to what this country is supposed to be about. But a huge historical force is rising to meet this challenge. It is rising among all those whose morality demands a just and decent society. It is a force rooted in the struggle of a new social class being created from the millions who are being cast out of the old economy as the new one is being born. This new class of poor is forced to fight for a new kind of society, free of police terror and free of want. Their morality demands that no one live in poverty and that the police exist to protect and serve the people, not to be their oppressors. Their vision of a new America, built on a foundation of justice and cooperation, would fulfill this country's promise, and it must be a vision that the rest of us organize around. That's it for this edition of People's Tribune Radio. Thanks to the overwhelming response to PTR in our first year, the program is now available twice monthly and on the internet at www.ptradio.org. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society where the same technologies of robotics and computerization that are being used to displace millions of workers worldwide is used for the benefit of the planet as a whole. If you'd like more information about the League, our Speakers Bureau, or our other print and audio publications, you can contact us at 1-800-691-6888. That number once again, 1-800-691-6888. My name's Mike Thornton. On behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, we invite you to join us next time for another edition of People's Tribune Radio.